Welcome to another virtual interview on Elaine's Literary Salon. I'm Jeffrey Higgins, and I own Elaine's Literary Salon with my wife, Cynthia. This is her restaurant. We've made Elaine's a literary hub for the Washington, D.C. area. And to date, I believe we've interviewed 163 or 164 authors. If you are an author or interested in meeting other authors, come to Elaine's or check out our podcast at elainesliterarysalon.com. Today, we're reaching out to the West Coast to interview Andrew Rubin. Andrew's a filmmaker, writer, and co-founder of the mental health education company Symptom Media, a graduate of NYU's Tisch School of the Arts, where he studied film production and history. He has spent over a decade in the trenches of Hollywood development as a screenwriter. Andrew co-directed the inspirational documentary Ride with Larry about Parkinson's, inspired by his father's battle against the disease. The film segment exploring Parkinson's and medical marijuana received global attention and helped spark a broader conversation about dignity, treatment, and the role of alternative medicine. Andrew is also the co-founder and president of Symptom Media, an innovative mental health education platform used by over 500 universities, hospitals, and medical schools worldwide to help train students and clinicians and destigmatize mental illness. Andrew divides his time between San Diego and Los Angeles. He's joining us today to talk about his debut novel, Hell or High Winter. So, Andrew, welcome.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be talking with you today. Thanks for having me all the way from D.C.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited to talk to you. We've had a bunch of us screenwriters on that were kind of author-centric in the podcast, so it's always fun to get a different take on things. Why don't we start off with this? Let's start off with Hell or High Winter. Give us a little synopsis. What's the book about?
Sure. I mean, the super short elevator pitch is it's Percy Jackson for adults. It's a contemporary fantasy, Greek mythology retelling, and it's about what happens when the gods are all living today without purpose. The main character is the trickster and messenger god Hermes from Greek mythology, and he's here in our modern day world, and he's wasting away his immortality, and all that's going fine and terrible at the same time until his sister Persephone is kidnapped again, if anyone knows the original mythology, and he has to go to the underworld, find her and rescue her and save Earth from eternal winter. And in the process, he's going to have to do some growing up, and he's going to find out that sometimes the most powerful element in the universe is not the worship of others, but it's having faith in yourself. I know that you have a diverse group of authors that come on and speak to your audience. And so the one thing I've found is that my book has been received really well with people that aren't into fantasy. I love all types of books, too, so I wasn't really trying to write specifically for one lane. But yeah, that's Hell or High Winter.
So what like genres and subgenres do you market it in? Because people do look for that, right? Bookstores look to shelve for a certain genre. What are the primary genres here?
Yeah, I think the primary genres are, and it's such an interesting question, and it's so important, especially if you are genre agnostic, like I like to call myself in the screenwriting world.
I love that.
the book, it's the lanes that it occupies on the bookshelves, I guess, when you would walk into a store. It's contemporary fantasy. It's Greek mythology retelling. I like to say it can be slotted in next to Neil Gaiman, or maybe where Neil Gaiman used to be, considering what's going on these days. It would be, you know, as much as it deals with themes that are and places that would be considered the realm of fantasy, I ground it in all the things that we're dealing with in our present day. And that was most fun for me. It's seeing how the gods would react to social media and smartphones in a world where no one is paying attention anymore.
It's such a cool idea. But when you're talking about like mythology, you're talking about fantasy. How do you adhere to like the tropes with that fantasy readers, for example, are looking for, but you have it in a contemporary setting. So you're also still dealing with modern issues and things. Like, I guess what I'm saying is like, how much do you bend to the tropes of like these genres versus, or do you even think about that when you're writing? Do you just write it and let it land where it lands?
Okay. Yes and no. That's a funny question. So it's such a trope heavy time, and you keep hearing new things all the time, like romanticy and all these. And like, if you're on the Bookstagram community, which I have been introduced to, and like, it's been like hitting me in the face in the whole marketing side of things. And I'm like, oh my God, I didn't realize there's all these rabbit holes. And so it's, the world is so trope heavy now with like male lead character and female protagonist tropes. And so none of that factors in when I'm writing, but I will say, to me, I'm the old school where I really wanted it to deal with Joseph Campbell and sort of the hero's journey arc. And that to me, I really connect with when it's like Tolkien and those sorts of stories and the journey and the rebirth and the coming home. And I'm sort of, and that I'm very consciously weaving into this story, and it's part of a trilogy, because I'm also having fun with the idea of what happens if a god is born again. And so that's a question that I'm going to answer later in the series. So in that sense, I'm sort of trying to deliberately adhere to in a self-aware way in the story itself.
So, I mean, the hero's journey is such a classic way to tell story, right? Sort of the way we all hear it in a lot of ways. It's almost separate and distinct from genre, right, by itself. Like you can use the hero's journey in almost anything. So do you think readers, are they driven a lot by genre, or is it the high concept of the story? Because it's a cool concept, right? What you've come up with here, I haven't heard it before. It sounds like something, you know, people would really be drawn to. But do you think they're looking at it like, oh, I want to find my next fantasy read, or they're looking at the high concept of your elevator pitch, or are they, you know, looking at a story that has like these more thematic elements that in the structure of a hero's journey?
God, I mean, if someone had the answer, if someone has the answer to that question, please tell me. I mean, not that I'm any expert in whatever answer I'm about to give you. I feel like people do tend to reach for the next thing that they've already read. So I feel like people are really drawn to like, oh, I really loved Greek mythology. Like I just read Circe, or I just read... there's like a whole spate of them. And so I feel like people will kind of move their way through those books, or there's this new one like Lit RPG, which I didn't realize existed until the whole Matt Denneman universe came about. So I feel like people can kind of get stuck in lanes, cause I feel like the algorithms and social media does that these days. I feel like everybody has the genre or the type of story that speaks to them, and they'll of course grab that book. I do hope mine sort of speaks to those broader audiences, just because I can, you know, I have all the elements that touch upon fantasy. I love mythology. That's a big passion of mine. And then, but I really love retellings. I really love revisionist history. And so like the idea of bringing all those elements into our modern world, I hope can speak to people that can't connect with something that's purely fantastical. And I mean, I have the luxury of using worlds that have already been well defined. So you might not know certain mythologies, but it's not a world building and a rules based, you know, some people that I think have issues with fantasy, like Tolkien, or they'll just dismiss them, is like when they start those books, they feel like they have to do this entire other mental work to read a book where, okay, well, what's happening here? What are these creatures? How does this world work? What's the function of this? Like, it's like they're dropped into another country, and culturally they're totally lost, and they're trying to understand that while they're trying to get into a story. So, in that sense, I feel like I'm kind of cheating. It's not a cheat. I'm not doing it consciously, but it is a cheat where I can take, you know, all these mythologies are the foundations for all of our cultures, and then bringing them into a world where no one has to sort of understand, like, oh, what's this thing called a smartphone that he's using? So maybe that is the extremely long-winded answer that hopefully makes some sense to some.
No, there's so much good stuff in there, and it's really smart too, because like when I talk to fantasy writers and fantasy readers, a lot of times it is that new world building that excites them so much. And as a matter of fact, one of the pitfalls for a lot of fantasy writers is they get too into the world building, and they can spend years building a world without actually writing their story, you know. But I can also see where, you know, for someone who doesn't read that, how that it can be a little intimidating to have to, you know, onboard all this information. So it's really smart that you would use a mythology as a way to do that.
And it's such a line you have to straddle to how much do you explain? And that's actually something, so I do, I'm a mentor for the Veterans Writing Program for the Writers Guild Foundation, which is such an amazing program that they put out, put on every year, and everyone's welcome to apply around the country as long as they're have served in some branch. But those people that are new, I mean, it's one thing to be new to writing, but then also to take on a world building project. And the trap that always seems to happen is over explaining everything. So people feel like they're reading an encyclopedia versus reading a book. And I've had to, that's a delicate line I've had to deal with too, both in writing the sequel with how much do I tap into that was the plot from the first book. That's a whole different challenge. But in the writing of the first one, getting into these mythologies, it's okay. I do have my own world building and my own rules. Like, you know, what is power to the gods? You know, how does that all work? Who is, you know, where does that come from? What happens between all the religions, and then also the myths themselves. Like, a lot of people have told me when I go, oh, my book is a retelling of the Hermes and Persephone myth, and they're like, what's that? Who are they? And I'm like, oh no, I have to go back and I have to tell the whole story. So yeah, there's this delicate balance of like how much forward movement in the plot and then how much taking a step back to explain that myth, that world that I've created. The thing that I chose to do, which to me was less of a choice and just something that I thought was fun, was really grounding those rules in the way our world works. So like the religions are basically like our governments. There's the superpowers. It's like, you know, we have Russia, America, China. and in the story, it's like, okay, you have Christianity, you know, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Muslim, and the Muslim world, they're all competing with each other, although Christianity and Muslims overlap in terms of our faiths. But anyways, we'll put that aside. And then, you know, for the rules in the book, like I thought it would be very interesting that faith is power, and whoever has the most worshipers has the most power in the world. And worship is like a drug for the gods. So just things that we could all relate to. And also kind of connect with the world we're living in, you know, where we're chasing social media followers, and the more followers you have, the more influence you have. And so, and that chase is a bit of a drug that we all are grappling with too.
Okay, you have so many really cool themes in this. I really like that. For going back to like what you're saying about the, like, you know, like describing the world and the original mythology, do you feel like any kind of responsibility to stay true to the original myths, or is it just a jumping off place for you?
It's a mixture of both. I do try to stay true to the myths, and I bring in, there's a lot of everything from Blackfeet mythology in the first book to Yoruba, West African mythology, Christian mythology, Greek mythology. Like, I'm really, it's like stirring the pot. I think any scholars of the mythology would probably be writing, if they read my book, and maybe they have, I don't know, but I feel like I'll probably get some like hate mail or some strongly worded letters. I do take definite liberties with them, but to me, that's nothing different than what everyone's done with mythology. Like, that's just how mythologies work. Every generation makes it their own. So I try to stay true to what the original myths and the gods represented, but then making their personalities and the sometimes, you know, for example, Persephone and Hades and her daughters, and sometimes there's debate over which is her which is her children and which are Hades' children, and are the, you know, so you can go down rabbit holes, and then there's, you know, you can always find some other source that gives you what you want. So in that sense, it's freeing a little bit to choose what works best for the story.
You mentioned how some people aren't familiar with the myths. Do you have to do any more like background or world building or explanation as you're talking to the reader, like more than you would in just something that was straight fiction, like straight sci-fi or fantasy? Like, do you, does the myth outside of what your plot and story and character arcs are doing really matter? You know what I'm saying? Like, do you have to go into what the original myth was, or was it only what you'd normally give them and how it relates directly to the plot or the character development?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And so the process itself was always a delicate balance all the way through with my writers group, with the editor. But there is a lot of having to, you know, maybe not, I don't want to say explain, because like no writer wants to be in the game of explaining anything in their work. But yeah, the original myths do actually matter in terms of the plot and the story. The idea of, you know, the Hermes and Persephone myth was the Greeks' way of explaining the changing of the seasons, and, you know, Persephone being kidnapped in Demeter and her mourning. And so in the book, when Persephone's taken again, Earth plunges into eternal winter, which causes a lot of problems for the religions that are in power, because they don't want people to know there's this thing called pluralism. And so, you know, it's not a great, it's not really good for them being in charge, with the humans knowing that, oh, wait, there are other gods as well. So they try to keep that under wraps. But yes, so like you would have to know some of the actual original myths. They play like a really important part in the story. You know, and it's also part of the personal relationships too. Like, it was really fun exploring what does a marriage look like several thousand years after it was born of a kidnapping, because that's essentially what Hades did to Persephone. So then they're forced to be together, and she has to, like, you know, like it's joint custody. She has to spend half of her year with him. And so what does that look like several thousand years after, like, nobody's even paying attention to them anymore and they're not in public life?
It's so interesting, this melding of like contemporary Moors and this mythology. The one question writers always hate is like, where do you get your ideas type of thing? But do you remember where the germ of this idea came from? Because it's fresh and it's kind of interesting. How did you land on this?
This question, I sort of hate this question.
I know, all writers do. I gotta know.
Because the origin of this story is so stupidly simple. and then I'm like, how did this one moment spark over 10 years of my life dedicated to it, and more than 10 years, which was I was taking a walk on my local beach with my brother, and we used to play a game where he would do like a game of Mad Libs, and he would be like, oh, and it was back when the movie Taken was first out, the first Taken, and like everybody was, it was all anybody could talk about. And he's like, name a Greek myth that's the plot of Taken. And I was like, oh, Hermes and Persephone. And then I was like, oh.
I love it.
And then, you know, now I'm like, this is now when he complains that all I'm doing is writing, because we work together. Which is not the case. I'm not always writing all the time. But like, I'm like, it's your fault. You're the one that came, you know, you asked the question.
So how does that light bulb moment feel? Because I know, like, the writers I know who are idea heavy, they come up with a lot of ideas. They're always asking what if, you know, they're always thinking about things. But when you have that moment, you're like, oh, that would hit like the zeitgeist, and it's, you know, it's a classic story, and what a cool idea. Tell us, what does that feel like, and how do you know if it's just a momentary like thing, or if it can actually hold up for a novel?
Oh my God, I literally have my term for it. It's not an original term at all. I call it like the spidey sense, when you're like, ooh, you're just like, everything's like, oh, that's good. And then sometimes it wears off when you start like scratching at the surface of the idea, and you're like, oh no, that actually doesn't work. It's really stupid. And then you like, but you know, it's good when there's something where it's just like, you feel it. And I've had it before when the military veterans in our program, they tell us their ideas, and you're like, oh, I have the spidey sense. And you're like, you have to work on it. And I'm like, you're excited to talk about it and dig into the idea. And then for mine, yeah, it's as if like the ideas keep stacking on top of each other. So it's like you wake up and you're like, oh, then there's another idea. And it's like you keep adding like little Legos and Tetris, and it just keeps building and building. And so if like the spidey sense grows into, oh, wow, now there's this character that I could bring in. And so, and then of course it's the question, is it a book? Is it a script? Is it a pilot? You know, those always
happen. Do you write these ideas down as they come to you? I think Stephen King says he doesn't write them down because it's good enough. He won't forget them. And I will forget them by the time I like have my next meal. You know, like I have to write everything down.
I do write them down. I'll write them down eventually. But I didn't even know he had that as a mantra. But that's actually, I don't write them down. It is. It's like one of those. If it's a real spark, I remember it and then I'll like write it down. But I didn't actually. Yeah, that's funny. I had no idea he's ever said that before. So that's kind of how I like, you know, if it's the things that I have to run to write down are like the specific ideas that are like, oh, okay, I need that for a scene or that's a great line of dialogue, like those sorts of things. But ideas themselves, if it lasts, it lasts for me.
You mentioned this a veterans group a few times. Were you a veteran?
No, I never served, obviously, in my family back in the day in World War II and the like. I feel like I'm always preaching about it because I just think it's such a wonderful program, not just for the people that are participating, but I just find it so valuable. I meet some of the most incredible people. And so to me, it's like it's a real privilege to be a part of it. And so I always like to. And then I never know, you know, who you come across that has served and they don't know about it. So every time I get a chance, I'm just always shouting from the rooftops about it because it's such a great opportunity. And there are so many other mentors and people that come into lecture. And I really have fun doing it. It's a lot of fun. I think it's. You know, you talk about the ways you keep up your skill as a writer, and obviously, and we were talking about before we started, writing every day and building habits. But the other two elements to me that are as equally as important is having a writer's group and having people to provide critique and keep you, keep you engaged in the writing process and accountable. And then the other part is teaching. I think, you know, not that everyone's a teacher, you have to do it formally, but the idea of helping explain the process, it really sort of deepens your own understanding of the process for yourself, whether you're conscious of it or not, I think.
I tutored in college and there were classes I was taking, you know, when I was tutoring the other students. And so, yeah, it's amazing, right? When you have to think about it and actually articulate what it is you're just doing properly. So how did you get into the program if you didn't serve?
It was just by sheer chance. There is this other wonderful writer, and she's been a mentor in the program forever. And she's a military brat, Christina Walker. She's a wonderful TV writer. And we were just having a random, we met, we're having dinner before an event. And she was like telling me all about it. And I audited a class, which happened to be the last. We were all in the Writers Guild library, and the head of the foundation walked in and was like, oh, you know, with this thing called COVID, we're going to shut down tomorrow, but we'll be back in a week. So, which maybe was a blessing in disguise because then everything moved to Zoom. So like, I was like, I got time. So
when you're meeting these service members, these veterans, people, they want to write, they have ideas. How do you balance like, because it's such a brutal business and also writing craft is so difficult, right? And there's so many mistakes. I still make mistakes every day when I'm writing, you know, so it takes so long. How do you balance like the critique versus keeping them excited and motivated to write? Because everybody thinks it's easy, right? Then they get into it and it's very difficult.
Yeah, that's a really hard challenge. We tell them that this is the friendliest environment in Hollywood they will ever get. Like, we are all motivated to see them succeed. And they have this great pitch night at the end of the year where they're pitching every year at the end of the program to real executives, showrunners, managers, agents. Like, it's amazing, the people. Wow. Because everyone wants to come in and support. And so it's a really amazing shot. And people have gotten staffed on shows and things. Wow. Eventually from the program or signed with representation. And it's, you know, it's really spectacular. I was just at the American Legion post for one of the mentees, and it's so weird to say mentee because he was a Vietnam veteran and he's amazing. And his script was selected for a read with John Lee Hancock, the director of The Blind Side. Wow. I mean, it was amazing. So it was so cool to be there. So back to the critique question. the program pulls no punches about how brutal the business is and about how brutal notes are, but we are doing it in a friendly way. And so it's really sort of a litmus test. It's like, if you can't handle this, there's just absolutely like, just don't bother doing it. Like, do it for the fun of it for yourself, because none of this is fun in the real world. A lot of times people are going through things. And so there is a huge degree of empathy that we all carry. And there's a lot of allowances that are made and should be made. But, you know, we do try to make sure that they get as close to a real experience as possible.
So taking notes, I mean, that can be difficult. And I mean, whether you're writing scripts or novels or whatever, the rejection is a constant, right? So what are the tips you give them about being able to handle that and rejection and to keep going? Because if only the people who persevere ever succeed.
Yeah, perseverance is the word of every day. The advice, and there's a lot of advice they get about note taking. There is now an entire like panel discussion they get at the beginning of the program about etiquette and how to take notes. There's a whole thing about how to listen for the note under a note. If one person tells you it, okay, think about it, take it. If it speaks to you, absolutely do it. There's the difference between notes you have to do and you have to figure out how to make them work because it's a job, and then notes that you are doing for yourself and you have to discern, is this going to improve or not, and how will I do it? So there's a lot of like, the advice is try to understand where the notes are coming from. Never be defensive. That's like rule number one. Never. As soon as someone's defensive, it's amazing how fast if you're giving the note or you have any part in the process of working with the writer, you just turn off immediately. You're like, I'm done. There's like so many other things you could be working on, your own scripts. Like, I don't need to fight you on your project. So the rule, yeah, rule number one, you just never be defensive.
I think a lot of writers understand that. Like, it's like people are trying to make the work better, right? So whether it's in your specific circumstance or it's an editor or whatever, they're just trying to make the work better. And when you're defensive, not only are you just like undermining their motivation is, but you're also undermining their credibility, right? Because they're in that position because they're successful and they know what they're talking about. So they might be wrong, you know, in that particular case, but they're trying. Like, it's I think that takes a while for people to understand how to do that.
Yeah, it's a huge skill. And it's hard. It's really hard because every story is personal. So like and that's the other thing. Don't take it personally. That's like rule number two. And then, I guess it's not my adage, but it's sort of, if one person gives you a note, think about it. If two people give you the same note, really, really think about it. If three people give you the same note, do it. Right. And then again, also, it's always the note under the note. Like, someone could be saying, you know, I really think this character is, They should be killing this other character. Why aren't they killing them? Change your whole story so they're the murderer. And then like, you're like, no, I don't want to do that. But maybe what they're really saying is your character doesn't have agency and I don't feel like they're actually moving somewhere in your story. So maybe it's not a murder that they need to commit, but they need to do something. So, you know, and you don't necessarily have to, it's not a prescription that you have to take that pill. So that's kind of another away. And all these things I say so that hopefully I say it out loud, so hopefully I can follow it myself when it's my turn. So,
well, it's interesting because you say, you know, teaching is a way that you learn this stuff yourself. And earlier you mentioned like that a writing group was one of the ways, right, to improve. How do you know though? Because I've worked with so many writers. I've been in different writing groups and I've worked with so many writers who were in groups that were actually toxic or not good for them. How do you know when this feedback you're getting, let's say you're getting it from one or two people in a group on a specific piece of writing, is it just experience that'll tell you, or is it your instinct on story? Like, how do you know when to believe it? You know what I mean? If it's a piece of advice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hopefully you have good judgment about the people that you've asked to read it and you know them well. And I mean, I think you really have to trust the people. You should really give it to people that you have and don't give it to people and that you're going to then lose the relationship with. That's nothing. I don't think anybody wants that. There's always like, if you feel demoralized afterwards, It's like, well, okay, if you're feeling demoralized by the feedback, is it because that person is maliciously giving these notes? Like, does it feel like it's coming from the person? Or maybe it's because it's hitting something where you, like, you know, it's, you know, you were high on your own supply and you're like, got to come down and sort of come to that realization yourself at some point. Or sometimes it's just not the taste. I've made that mistake. I've given my stuff, you know, I gave this project early on to someone who gave me brutal, brutal feedback. And it made me kind of really doubt the whole project for years. And I didn't show it to anyone else again. And then I told that experience to some mutual friends. And they're like, why would you give it to him? You know he hates those stories. Like, that's your fault, not his. And not the stories. So,
you know, that is very true. I've in a writing group, I've given a different like subgenre of thriller to people in my writing group who didn't read that subgenre. And all of the problems they had with it were things that people who read that subgenre wanted and demanded, you know? So you're 100% right with that. Yeah. You got to get the right reader for the right project.
Yeah. And you have to trust them too. Like if, you know, you can't just give it to your neighbor and, you know, I mean, unless your neighbor, Stephen King, give it to your neighbor, but you know, you can't just give it to somebody and expect them to have like the most eloquent, perfectly. And this is speaking from someone who worked with a producer who did give it to his neighbor to give to her daughter because it was a YA book adaptation. And so, and it's like, great. Like we want her to see the movie, but like, she's not really a master at storytelling that we want to take these notes. You know, so make sure, yeah, you trust the person that has a good, you know, and not that they have to be a writer, but, you know, if they're also a reader and someone that is reading in your genre or just has the capacity to really have a conversation with you that that is not judgmental, but constructive.
Oh, that's great. Great advice. I'm curious with these veterans. Do you notice like is there a difference in the writing or the way they approach writing or the way they approach notes from other people? Because you've been doing this a long time, from other people that you interact with. Like, is something with that experience as I've had? Do you see it in the writing besides the specifics of like, say, writing about like, you know, action or something like that? Do you see a different type of person?
Well, I mean, yeah, they're really good at writing action. And they're really good at knowing, they know a lot of things, a lot. I mean, like the military, like the American military really trains people well. I mean, we have to, that's a big investment that people make with their lives. And they come out with a lot of interesting skills. I think the one biggest difference, because everyone can also have like an issue taking notes. It doesn't, you know, because we've had a fair share of those in the program. It's, I think, the not just the discipline, but it's the sort of reactive nature to just take notes or direction as a command. If maybe that's an exaggerated way of saying it, but there is also sometimes where it's like, okay, just because we told you this isn't like you're not. We are not your officers or whatever rank it is. We're not giving you orders to do this. Like it's an exercise for you to, you know, absorb this feedback. Although a lot of times we get it where they take none of ours. So I say that, and a lot of times we'll give notes and every week it's the same script. And we're like, This is so painful. Like I can't keep reading the same pages every week because you take nothing. So I don't know.
Maybe I work with people like that too. Yeah.
So I guess, you know, so maybe there's, I just undercut my entire answer.
No. And you know, thank you for doing all that work too with these veterans, because I mean, they have stories to tell, you know, and it's really cool that writing can both be, you know, an art form for people to enjoy, but it can also be an outlet and a therapeutic outlet, right, for the writer themselves. So I'm sure it's bringing a lot to people who've probably been through a lot of things in their life.
Yeah. They a lot of them have been through a lot, and some people can't finish the program. We try to steer them away from sometimes personal stories, because that's a very tricky thing, giving notes as well. And you know, and yeah, and it's definitely impacted people, whether it was, I don't think it was the program itself, but yeah, it's very therapeutic in storytelling, and it doesn't have to be your own to be beneficial.
Yeah, no, I think that that's really smart too. When you are the protagonist in your story, it makes it harder to take notes, right?
That, and that's also not a military problem. That's not a veteran problem.
So you mentioned 10 years earlier. Did this book take you 10 years to write? How long were you working on this project?
Yeah, I like to say it's a 10-year odyssey. It did not take me 10 years to write it. Although I feel like the sequel is for the issue of discipline, not it's taking me far longer than it should. The writing itself took, I would say, like a year and a half. And I was really disciplined almost every day. I would drive down. It was over 10 years ago, and we were starting my business with my brother, and we were living at home to save money and all that stuff. And so I would every morning wake up super early, drive to our local beach, put a towel in the window so that when the sun rose, it wouldn't go through the window and blind my computer. And I had the other doors open to the waves.
I do that too, by the way. I do that exact thing. I drive to the beach and open the doors, and it's fantastic. It's
so perfect. And then, of course, my new car has this like unmovable seat rest in the middle, so I can't lay across the back seats like I used to. So I'm like, oh, it's that little thing has just ruined my beach riding because I don't have like a hatchback to like lay in the trunk. I know that sounds so weird to people, but it really is a great way to write. And it's also very calming. And then I would go for a run and then switch gears and work on my company for the rest of the day. So it was a year and a half of doing that. And then, I gave it to the wrong person. I got really brutal advice. And then I had imposter syndrome. And I was like, who am I to write a book? So I sat on it for like 7 years. And then circumstances changed. I took it off the digital shelf. I spent like over a year, maybe 2 years, just slowly rewriting it. Like I had changed a lot as a writer. So I went straight back and I just went through it as a new person, with new skills. And then, that's when I took it out. So
he brings up such an interesting point there because, you know, with every book, you're a different writer at the end than you were when you started it. So when you go back to an old work like that and you have changed as a writer, I mean, has everything changed? Has a voice changed? Do you feel like you have some responsibility to keep the story and maybe the feel and the pacing that as it was? Or are you just completely starting over as a different writer?
No, I mean, I didn't just completely scratch it and start over. I loved the voice and the pacing, and I think a lot of that came from you can't really have a voice in screenwriting. I like to say it's sleight of hand to have a voice in a script as a writer on the page, versus your characters. And so it was more, I think, just the construction and the detail. And I think there was more trust. That's what also came. So not just the skill and the technical skill of writing and but the ability to articulate really much bigger and deeper themes and to just dig into them in a really raw way and have that ability to articulate. So I didn't like rewrite and change the pacing and change. I actually didn't even change the plot at all, but I found things that I was like, oh, okay. This was just a little minor blip that in a screenwriting world, it would just be, okay, you have that and you're done. And it's just a side character, but like, okay, in the world of novels, this is big. Like this is a bigger idea and I can see it stretching for becoming a bigger thing in the second book and a massive thing in the third book. So, you know, and then plus like the internal monologue and really, it was almost like marinating on that. And then being someone that could look back, you're like, okay, I was in my early 20s when I started this. Now I'm in my 30s. And not that that makes me wiser by any stretch, but I mean, there's a certain perspective shift and more life that happens, losing a parent and all these other things that, you know, I feel like you just have, there's more depth and an ability to trust bringing that out onto the page.
I heard some writer, I can't remember who it was, a big best-selling author, and he said nobody should write in their 20s. Like, he didn't feel like he had enough life experience. I disagree with that, you know, but he felt like he had to live a little bit before you could actually write about life. You mentioned sleight of – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I don't believe, like, you can't write in your 20s or you don't have enough life. Yeah. I mean, I definitely had a lot of life and whether, yeah, that was not the problem. I think it was, anyways, go ahead, please, your next question.
It depends on the person. When you said, like, sleight of hand to have voice in the script, how much, if you're, like, writing a spec script as a writer, how much do you make it be, like, beyond, like, say, you know, you're in a writer's room or you're actually writing the script, something that's under contract, like, is being made, that's a different writing, right? But if you're writing a spec script and you're trying to make the actual experience of reading the script for a reader enjoyable, how do you put one foot on either side of that? Like, how do you make it an interesting read, but also give them what they're expecting in a script? Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Oh, it completely makes sense. And there's some people that just, I'm blanking on his name. He was like the king of being able to have a voice in scripts. He wrote the Lethal Weapon, original Lethal Weapon. Oh God, this is just a brain. It just popped out of my head. He was the king of having a voice on the script. But yeah, there's like, on one end, it's Tarantino. And on the other end, it's reading a blueprint for a house. Tarantino can do whatever he wants. there's a level of technical expectation that comes from, especially if you aren't known, that if someone's going to open up your script, being entertaining, first of all, is paramount. And so there is, I feel like, a lot more ability to be a very specific screenwriter now and have that voice in a script. And I think if you're going to make a spec, it better have a really great hook, like a really great thing that people are like, wow, I've never heard of that before. I got to check this out. Also, be really compelling. And then and then super entertaining and make people move fast and flip through the pages. It's such a tricky thing. It's one of those, like, when you see it, like, it, you know it. You know, I think you can't just kind of go guns blazing into a script, especially if you aren't known, and be like, I'm going to put emojis in my script. And you're going to have a lot of people going like, are you kidding me? And then like page one done, not moving past it. And so you really have to follow. And that's one of the big differences between prose and screenwriting is you really have to follow a lot of rules. And if people don't know who you are and they see like you're just breaking all these rules, they're just going to think I'm not going to bother with this story. So I think if, you know, the sleight of hand and the voice can come in the prose, and you can do fun things in parentheticals, in the dialogue that kind of, like, it's a wink and a nod to the reader. You know, you're not directing the actor, but you're certainly giving people like a sense of what the feel is. And I think that's, if you can pull off that hat trick where your every line is a camera shot, but then also you're giving, making it a wink and a nod. If your script is funny, make sure even the prose is funny. The description of the character, if it's thrilling and it should move, like, make sure, like, use the spacing on the page to make people feel like they're tripping down the page as your character is falling off a mountain and trying to make sure he grabs onto a rock before he slides over a cliff. Like, give people the feeling of your movie on the page. And I feel like that's where the sleight of hand voice really comes in.
You know, and a lot of those techniques are used in prose too, right? Like, it's having white space and short chapters and being able to push people through a thriller, for example. When you were writing this, what surprised you about writing prose as opposed to scripts? Like, you probably knew most of this going in, right? But was there anything that stuck out as like hard or that came easier, that was more fun when you were writing the novel?
Oh, I mean, the more fun, definitely, where you could just kind of go and you can go into the internal space of a character that you can't do in a script. And then you can have freedom to explore things the way you couldn't, and not being so confined to rules and slug lines and all that, you know, well, fun stuff. The final draft makes you click tab every 5 seconds. So it was really the space that it gives you was the best part. And then that's also the hardest, was sort of trying to figure out how to construct things and keep things moving and visual, and really visual in a way that's in poetic and lyrical. And so, I mean, I feel like there's just so much more that goes into that side of things. There was a really interesting talk that I got to see at the American Library Association years ago, and I had already written the first draft, but it made me go back into it in a really different way. And it was Lois Lowry with Jeff Bridges, and both of them were photographers. And, you know, maybe I've just imagined this in my head, but I swore she was talking about the idea of being a photographer, which I am too. I love photography, and using lenses, and how you would select a lens to shape the image that you're creating. And each lens carries a different purpose. You're not going to use a telephoto lens to capture a landscape. Like, you're going to zoom in. And so she was like describing how like the wide angle lens was giving her the majesty of everything. And so she's like, I'm starting a scene. Like, where are we? And then like, okay, I want to get into some emotional depth. Like, I'm going to get in a 50 millimeter lens where it's a very tight focus and very narrow depth of field, and because it's really just on that face and that one emotion. And then, oh, it's a thriller and there's a detail and they left something on the table, like that's a telephoto lens, and we're just hyper focused on one thing. And so it was sort of that idea that, you know, in a script you're writing for somebody else and an entire crew of people to film something, and in prose you are the camera. You are looking through the camera. You're not, it's you, that process is yours rather than a blueprint for other people to put it on camera.
I'm a really visual writer, so that really lands with me. And which do you enjoy more? Do you enjoy writing scripts or prose?
Oh, totally equal, I think. I've gotten to now. It's 50, like it's a different hat. You sit down for a book and it's one hat, and working on some script projects, it always feels like a totally different self that has to deal with that. And then within that, of course, TVs versus pilots versus feature scripts are different hats too.
So I'm interested about that. Like, how did you get into this? Like, what do you remember the first time story really captivated you, or, you know, because it's all a different medium for telling story, right? Like, when did you get the bug?
Oh man. I don't feel like there was one moment where it like bit me where I'm like, I mean, I could say that for traveling when I fell in love with travel, but it was always my dad. I think he always wanted to be a writer. And he loved movies and books, and he was always inside of a book, head in the pages of a book, or watching movies together. And so we did that. That was growing up, like, and also that meant watching movies I probably shouldn't have been watching at certain ages. So that was it was just the world that he steeped me in, and so I always just loved it. And we would have long conversation when I was getting into this, and to my parents' credit, like, that was pure just them being supportive. And, you know, there was never a bias against, well, you have to go get a different degree, like, this isn't a career.
When you sit down to like watch a movie, or like the physical process around reading a book or watching a movie or something, does it bring back those feelings of like familial love that you had? Like, do you connect to like a younger version of yourself just in the process, even before it starts?
In the actual work itself?
In the work, or watching a movie, like, you know, because you mentioned like what these moments with your dad, right, and watching movies together, and there's, it's not just the movie, right, it's being together and the family and the feeling around story that you've melded with your familiar relationships. So now when you go to watch a movie, or you go to write a movie, right, or do you feel that connection, that emotional connection to your past?
I mean, I wouldn't say so consciously. I mean, I think obviously, yes, if I'm watching something, if I'm watching something or I'm reading something, I'm just, as long as it's good, at least for me, I fall into it, and the whole world disappears for me. And I love it, and always have. And I guess so I say unconsciously, because I think the fact that I'm doing this and I continue to do it, like, it must be the foundation. So I don't know if I, you know, I do consciously, it is always aware to me that his love of it and his desire to have that for himself and for me, like, that's always sort of a North Star. And so I think, for better or worse, and it probably, you know, drives my family nuts why I pursue something that's so brutal and there's so much rejection and, you know, it is so hard and not easy, being redundant. That it must, like, that absolute insanity to do this. I mean, it must come from something very deeply rooted, though I don't want to make it his fault.
Well, do you feel like storytellers are made, or are you born with something that gives you this story, this propulsion, right? Something within you that's like, I've talked to a lot of successful writers who would write even if no one read their work, you know, like they have this need to tell stories. Do you feel that?
I think so. I mean, I was going to say, anybody could be story, but I really think it was always really early for me that I loved it. I think the difference was for me was getting over sharing stories. I was very inhibited and self-conscious and not like even the idea of talking about scripts. Like, I didn't want people to know that I was writing scripts at a coffee shop. Well, one, because it's a cliche. So you just feel so like, oh God, I'm that guy. But the idea of like sharing it, like it felt like even as I was moving past, like I had to do it in college. I went to film school. Like, you had to pitch your story. But for some reason, it always felt like me with like toys being 5 years old playing on the carpet. And so it was like very like I felt like, oh God, this is it's silly and I shouldn't. And I had the first writing partner that I had who was a mentor. That was the thing that he beat me up about. He was like, he beat me up about a lot of things. But that was a big one. It was like, no, you have to talk about stories. Share the story. Tell me the story. And I do think that is its own skill, and some people are born with it and some people aren't. And so I think if you have the stories in your head, it's yet another layer to be like doing it in a conversational way. I do think the idea to be compelled to tell stories is something that, I mean, we all are. I mean, obviously, innately, that's our nature. But I think the idea to do that for a living, because everyone always says like, oh, I can write a novel, I can write a book, or I can write a script. And you're like, oh my God, you can't when you read it.
It's really hard. You know, it's so funny when you say like playing on the floor, right? I was just using that analogy with somebody the other day who was kind of complaining about the writing. I'm like, do you get where we're still 5 years old? We're still playing with our G.I. Joe or whatever. We're just making up stories in our head and we get to do that. Like, that to me, that's so much fun. It's a gift.
And the funniest anecdote I have of that was when I was really little, there was a Lego building competition. This sounds very random. And it is. And I remember it so vividly. And my parents love to tell this story because it was me. I was in elementary school with my best friend. And we used to just always play Legos all the time. And it was before Legoland opened up in San Diego. So there was like this big Lego building competition. And so, you know, I don't know how it happened, but we got entered into it. And so we arrived being, I don't know, I think we were maybe 10, 11. And all the other competitors were adults. Like, we thought it was for kids. And they were those like master builders, like, we're going to do the Eiffel Tower and we're going to do this. And, you know, I remember it was so fascinating. It was at our local mall and it was like, it was an event. And each person had like they literally had filled up trash cans. And then they were like, go. And then you had to dump it out and start building. And so like these adults were like, let's make the Mona Lisa out of Legos in 1 hour. You had like a ticking clock and the judges are walking around in circle. And then it's me and my friend, because this is what we did as kids. And so there was like time's up and the judges went around to see what you built. And each adult was like, I built the Mona Lisa. And then they got to us. And I remember we kept the judges for like 15 minutes because we were like, and then it was this spaceship that landed here. And then there were dinosaurs. And then there was this and this. And we won. And the adults were so angry. And we And it was like, because it was, they were like, this is our competition. And but they were like, well, looking back, it was hilarious because we were doing what Lego wanted, which was to like create this, you could have the ability to create a world. And so that's what we had done. And yeah, it was hilarious. So we won first place in this, like beating out all of the master Lego builders. And the stuff we built was chintzy little things. They were not like, they probably didn't look what we were like, anything like what we were describing.
But it was the imagination, right? Like, and I think somewhere along the way, people lose that as they get responsibility and move into adulthood. And I think that's why people watch things on Netflix and why we read books, because we want to stay connected to that realm of the possible, right? And the thing, and to be able to transport ourselves. And the fact that, I mean, you get to do that for a living. That's really cool.
It is so much fun. And the places you go and all your stories. I mean, that's also kind of like the fun part about, you know, hey, I'm going to set this in this exotic location. As screenwriters, you're always trying to do that. Like, no, it really has to be in Bali, like this mystery. Like, it can't be anywhere else. And I have to go to set because you're going to need me for rewrites. But then, yeah, but it just takes you and you learn so many interesting things with different, and you meet so many fascinating people. And the energy around people that want to open their doors to help storytellers is incredible. That always amazes me.
We do have, you know, a lot of script writers who watch this, and I've interviewed several of them. Do you know, like, I mean, things have changed, right, quite a bit since COVID and, like, in recent years. Do you have any sense for what people are looking for now? Like, what are producers looking for in Hollywood? Is it more feature film? Is it more pilots? Or what are they seeking?
Oh, I mean, God, another question I wish I had the answer to. Other than just my own philosophical ramblings, what the business is looking for. God, I wish I was more tapped into it. I don't even have representation right now. So I don't have those people I used to have. So I don't even have those people saying, this is what the business wants, which is always usually like what it just had. And so you're chasing after a trend. So like, yeah, do you have, you get that call like, okay, do you have any like sexual thrillers? And you're like, no. And they're like, everyone wants them. And you're like, okay, well give me 8 months to write one for you. And then no one will want it anymore. The idea of like what people are looking for, I think there's always like what the business is looking for. And there's literally memos that circulate, like what the mandates and what people want. And it's always what was just successful. I really think people are going to be hungry for real experiences. I feel like the world is so burnt out, whether it's dating apps or online forums. I have a friend who's a wonderful actress, and she does immersive theater, and she brought me to it, let me come to one of her performances in Los Angeles. And it was the most stunning thing. It was like being inside of a movie. And that's what she does for like Netflix and these companies, and creating these immersive live experiences. So, I mean, maybe it's just I'm like high off of that incredibly creative experience that I got to be a part of. As an audience, where I'm not going to participate. I'm not an actor. I'm too self-conscious. And then by the end of it, I'm sitting at a dinner table with the other guests and the actor. And I'm like, I think he was molested by the dead brother. And, you know, so that like the way, but I do feel like that's kind of partly the future is some sort of live experience. But as far as like what we do, and by the way, she said that it's like a 600-page script to make that thing a reality. Wow. So it is not unscripted. For the writers have a major role to play in that. But then what for books and movies and TV shows? Oh, yeah, everyone's always asked, please tell me. Hopefully it's what I've already written. That's what I'm hoping is the future.
I think you're on the money though with the live experience thing. Like younger people are wanting physical copies of books now. They want covers that are textured and beautiful, right? And when we do like noir at the bars here, yeah, exactly. I mean, they're craving something that's tangible and physical. And when we do our noir at the bars here at Elaine's Literary Salon, you know, people will like make mistakes or they drop a paper or they can't find their thing. And that's the good stuff. It makes it real. It makes it human. You know, it makes all this polished like digital stuff. And now with all the AI, I think people are really craving like connection to other people.
Yes. And I should have, that's the other big part of the live experiential part. AI, we literally cannot tell what is real anymore. And we've outsourced a lot of that stuff to like artificial voices. And, you know, that's a whole other discussion, obviously. And I mean, there's a place for it and there's a place where it shouldn't be. But yeah, I think all that just breeds the noir at the bar. I love noir at the bar. And the most recent one I went to, some friends were speaking at it. And it was packed. I was like, I was so surprised because I'm used to it being in a small kind of dingy bar. And it was like a handful of people pre-COVID. And now it was full house. And I loved it. It was great. I mean, I always loved the event, but then to see people want to show up to be with other people, I think.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And that's also from like the reader or the viewer's position. But for writers, like if you're in one of these live reading events, you get to see the reaction. If you're writing something funny, if people aren't laughing, you see it. Like you can feel it landing with them, you know, and that's so different. It's even different than being on Zoom or something when you're in the room with other human beings. I have a million things I want to ask you, but we're running out of time
this
here.
This has been a lot of fun.
Well, let me ask you, for this debut, was this the first book you wrote or did you write other manuscripts before?
Actually, yeah, this was the first book I ever wrote.
Wow.
And yeah, first I have others that I've started, but I've literally just doubled down and now I'm writing the sequel. So.
Well, congratulations on that. Tell me, how did it feel as a debut when something's out of your head and now you're holding a book in your hands? Like, what is that debut moment like for you?
Oh, that was really powerful. I did not hold my book till the day of the book launch at the bookstore. That was the first time I got to have, because I didn't get the copies, whatever, the advanced reading copies. Yeah, that was powerful. That, when it really hit me, I've been really conditioned as a screenwriter to not believe anything is real until it's real. So like that means signed on the dotted line, there is money in your bank account. Otherwise it ain't happening. And even then it might not be real. So like the idea that I've gone to friends' houses and they show me their book, or I see like a bookstagrammer that I'm, you know, I sent a copy to and it's on his bookshelf behind him. And I'm like, oh my God. Something I did was actually to completion, and it's people are reading it and they're going to tell me what they think, but it's not like I'm going to go back and make changes anymore. It's done. Like the idea of done is something I've never had. So
it is a cool experience. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Do you want to tell people, I mentioned your Ride with Larry documentary. Do you want to tell people where they could find that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's still available on Amazon Prime. Parkinson's groups around the country and around the world still show it. So definitely if anyone's dealing with Parkinson's, they can just go to Amazon Prime and search for Ride with Larry. And then there's lots of clips online and sometimes people trying to debunk our stuff about medical marijuana. So don't look at that. But yeah.
Well, it was just descheduled or taken off Schedule 1, right? For Schedule 2 just recently. Do you feel like your work on that had anything to do with helping that along?
God, I don't. I mean, I hope so. I would love to think that's the case. I mean, it went viral. It was over 500 million views. Wow. Joe Rogan recently played it on his podcast. There was a BBC special that featured it, and they did a whole episode on it about it. So, I mean, I like to think it changed the conversation. My dad used to talk about CBD, and people were like, what is that? But we like to think of him. He passed away from Parkinson's and cancer, but we like to say he's Mary Jane's apostle because his message has spread far and wide. I think no one could ever know, but I would like to think there was a definite before and after of the acceptance, and the fact that our subject was a retired police officer in a red state that did not allow that he could have gone to jail if they found him using it. And it showed a legitimate need and it humanized it in a way. And I think it gave people permission to understand that there's other uses for this. So I would love to think that allowed it to move into a non-political space.
I mean, there's definitely therapeutic efficacy for this. I mean, there's been a lot of studies on it over the years. You know, I just want to say for you for doing that, too, for going something like having to deal with Parkinson's and the family and like the tragedy of this. But to take that like really negative, difficult thing to live with, but then turn it into this amazingly transformative like documentary that, you know, it's like the best of humanity, in my opinion. Right. Because that's you take something terrible and you do something just heroic with it. So that's your hero's journey. So I thank you for
that. No, I mean, I only pointed a camera and it was purely the people that were on camera. And I don't say that and any sort of like, oh, self-effate, like trying to be modest way. It was really them, you know, so, and the caretakers. So it felt like more of the privilege to be able to tell people's story than it was to be a hero's journey to go sit in Final Cut Pro for a year. So,
well, I love what you did. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
Do you have anything coming up or anything you'd like to drive? Where should people go to get your book? Let's start there.
Oh, please. And reviews are so helpful, especially for debut books and indie presses. They can go on hellerhighwinter.com, and I'm on Instagram, AndrewRubin77, because there's 76 more of me out there somewhere. Hellerhighwinter.com, and it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all those places. Got some events on the West Coast that are lined up, and I would love everyone's support and would love to hear what people think too, if they just want to share their thoughts, whatever they are.
Well, I always ask viewers if they would go out and rate your book on Amazon. It's like something like 70% of all book sales, and just taking 30 seconds and rating it makes people who haven't read you willing to take a chance when they see these other positive ratings.
So big. I am in the business of begging people to review my book now, because we're all slaves to the almighty algorithm.
So. Hey, there's 3 million books a year coming out. It's hard to break out. So when something's fun like this, I think people should take a look at it. I think they'll like it, and I think they should rate it for you. That certainly helps.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Of course. Well, listen, thank you so much for your time. This has been a lot of fun. What? Give us your website one more time.
It's hellerhighwinter.com, and not Hell or High Water. Everyone wants to do Hell or High Water. Hell or High Winter. So, yeah, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Andrew. We appreciate it.